The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
I think the lunch was so good nobody wants to come inside. But I think let's start, and by the time I've introduced everyone, I think we'll have more people inside. So welcome everyone to this panel on trends in foreign investment. The way we've set up this panel is we have three speakers. Two of them, and I'll introduce the speakers in a minute, are going to give case studies of the foreign investment regulation in their countries. And the countries, and let me introduce, we'll go, I guess we'll start on the right and then we'll move across. So we'll start with Indonesia and Surya Natamaja, who is an alum from 1987 and practicing law in Indonesia, to talk about the situation in Indonesia. After he finishes, then Marco de la Vega from Bolivia is going to talk about the foreign investment law in Bolivia. And those are two countries which have got interesting foreign investment situations in various ways in their country. So that'll give us some nice country information. And then we're delighted to have a non-alum that we wish was an alum, but Motoko Aizawa, who is an advisor in the Sustainable Development Network at the World Bank. And before that, worked for a number of years in the legal department at the International Finance Corporation, and also known as an advisor on sustainable development issues in the IFC. And Motoko is going to talk more generally about trends in foreign investment globally rather than with specific countries. And then we'll open it up for a general discussion, because I know there are many of you here who are working on investment transactions in many different parts of the world. So it'll be nice to get some discussion as well. So I think if each person speaks for, say, 10, 12 minutes, and then we'll have lots of time for good discussion. If you're going a lot over that, I'll give you a warning, but I won't be super strict on you. So Surya, I'll start. With,
no problem.
The only thing is just push the button on the thing so people can hear you.
I don't know how to start. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Okay. Nice to meet you. So I'm going to talk about the FDI, or foreign direct investment in Indonesia. Actually, it's probably not very interesting for you guys here, you know, because probably you're not going to Indonesia to invest anyway, you know. But anyway, I don't have any paper, so I'm going to talk about it because this is the paper that I wrote in 2010. So, and I make some money as well from doing this practice, you know, FDI, because since like 78, 79, and then I start practicing in 1983, the foreign investments coming to Indonesia up to now, actually. So as a matter of clarity, the term foreign direct investment of FDI is used here to distinguish it from the investment made by acquiring the shares of an Indonesian company from the stock market. So this is going to be direct investment, like people bringing in money and or buying company in Indonesia, not through the stock market. FDI can also be done by acquiring shares of established foreign investment company. The effect of foreign direct investment is to ascertain the shareholding of foreign investor in a limited liability company as regulated by the law number 40 of 2007. I don't think you care much about this, right? Because it's only numbers, you know. So if you need anything about the real regulation, you can research on the internet, or you can email me so I can give you more thorough explanation about that. But one thing that interests me most is why people doing the FDI, actually. So I make a search this morning, and then I think I think people doing investment is because of the tax incentives and then the leniency of the foreign currency control in that country. This is with regard to Indonesia, we have no foreign currency control. And then convenient labor regulation, and then convenient import and export regulation, and stability in politics. Indonesia is not very stable in politics for if you watch CNN, you know, but don't believe what CNN say, because people keep coming. And then sustainable raw materials, especially in natural resources, because people coming in for mining. And then certainty in law enforcement, this is the problem. The certainty in law enforcement in Indonesia is kind of 50-50, people say, because sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, but no grounds of law. And then strong local market. The population is like 280 million now, and then the affluent people is growing, so it's good for the local market. And then there is no nationalization guarantee from the government. This, probably this is also interest, make Indonesia more interesting for the investors. And then for Indonesia itself, FDI is good because it's creating jobs and for technology transfer and tax income, of course, and trickling down economy. And then where is Indonesia now in the world, actually? Indonesia is one of the country that's a member of G20. I wonder why G20, because the member is only 19, actually. It's called G20 anyway. Indonesia is in group 5 with China, Japan, and South Korea. In group 1 is Australia, Canada, Saudi Arabia, USA. Probably you all know this, right? And then the group 2, India, Russia, South Africa, and Turkey. Group 3, Argentina, Brazil, and Mexico. Group 4, France, Germany, Italy, and UK. So Indonesia now is in, still very interesting country to invest. The first one is China. China is the most favorable country to invest now. Second is India, and then the third one is Indonesia, with the parameter of the G20 countries. So based on the rankings by the UNCTAD, the United Nations Conference on Trade Development in July 2012, number one investment destination is China, number two the US, number three India, number four Indonesia, just recently going up to number four after Brazil. Now Brazil is number five. And then in Asia itself, we have ASEAN countries. ASEAN is the group of countries starting with 5 members in 1967. Now it's 10. Indonesia is number 2 after Singapore as the investment destination. Number 3 is Vietnam. Number 4 is Malaysia. So I guess that's it that I want to share with you. And then if you have any question, please do. Thank you.
I have a question regarding your remark on the reason why specific countries attract a lot of FDI. You spoke about the ease with which you can get foreign currency back out.
Yes.
Also, the incentives that are offered for companies to come, and a couple of other factors. And as you were listing those factors, I thought to myself, if I hear those factors, China should be at the bottom of foreign direct investment, because you can't get less than Indonesia, yet China is number one. Indonesia, with all of its political flaws, is number four in the world. So there are other factors involved in attracting FDI. And if I may speculate, but I'm happy to hear other perspectives, I think my reason for that is commercial demand. Companies will overlook a lot of flaws if they think that there is a lot of potential from a commercial perspective in the market. That's why they put up with the stuff they put up in China and also in other tough jurisdictions.
I mean, you're raising some very important points, which I think really need to be discussed. But I think rather than open up the discussion before we've had the... let's put that on hold and come back to it at the end, because I think those are critically important points to discuss. But let's hear about Bolivia, which is from a big country to a small country, but an important one for investment.
Thank you very much. As Daniel said, I come from a very, very small country called Bolivia, which is at this particular moment part of this South American axis led by Venezuela, among Ecuador, Nicaragua, and these countries. Anyway, this is not a political intervention or speech. This has just academic purposes. I am an alumnus. My class was 1999, so I'm very glad to be back here after more than 10 years. My name is Marco Lasso de la Vega, and I just opened my own law firm like a year ago. I'm going to talk briefly about my perceptions about FDI all around the world, and then case of Bolivia and its current new legal regulations and new constitutional provisions. The importance of foreign direct investment is generally unquestionable for both recipient countries and big, large international companies. This particular interest that followed my research for the last month or so was led to discover what is behind the foreign direct investment in natural resources, especially in countries, small countries like Bolivia. You know that South American countries, small Asian countries, African countries, followed for decades what was dictated by the FMI, the World Bank, and so on. Unfortunately, those recipes didn't work out the way it was expected. What was the recipe for growth and prosperity, especially during the mid-late 90s, where privatizations were the most important things in Latin America? It was demanded for small countries, developing countries, to attain and obtain political stability, to get sound rule of law, to get a trustful judiciary, honest and capable public servants, flexible labor obligations, some incentives, economic incentives like tax cuts, some sort of low natural resources exploitation fees, favorable international arbitration venues, and that kind of things, including bilateral or multilateral trade treaties to protect their investments. As I said, unfortunately, and this is the Bolivian case, the recipe didn't work out. So we are facing what's behind the state policy power and how to balance the policy of attracting investments in these countries. For many centuries, the Japanese understood what's the meaning of market protection, but their brave samurais were defeated 400 years ago by the gunpowder of the Royal Army and the Dutch, among other strong armies and capitals behind them, of course. So the Bolivian government, which is in place for the last 5 years so far, understood a new mechanism of protection, which is trying to balance this state police power and the attraction of foreign investments. As you probably know, Bolivia is one of the poorest countries in the world, even though it holds 50% of the world's lithium, and it's the third country in South America owning gas reserves. President Morales, 3 years ago, enacted a new constitution trying to make a big change in this respect. This new constitution has a lot of controversial new provisions that I will explain to you. First of all, the constitution forbids to conduct international arbitration processes regarding oil and gas businesses. So that means that all arbitration processes are going to be local, domestic. The new constitution established regarding this exploitation of natural resources a new power for community surveillance or control. It also gave to indigenous communities decision-making powers over the land, especially when they have oil or gas resources on their lands. Yet to be regulated, this new constitution grants legal priority to local companies against foreign companies as well. The constitution also forbids concessions vis-a-vis natural resources, replaced by short-term, less binding service contract with oil and gas companies. It also established the non-prescription of debts in favor of the state and strong employee-biased labor provisions. Ironically, the Bolivian government started to renegotiate all the concessions and oil and gas contracts with foreign companies, but none of those foreign companies left the country, even though fees and taxes increased 3 times. So what are we learning of this experience? That probably 10 years ago, former governments gave away those natural resources with no real or sound policies. According to this, many questions arise, like, are we facing a new approach regarding state policy power in South America? Is this the beginning of a new stage of the relation investors recipient countries? Is this just a current political trend in South America? Is this sustainable? Is this kind? Are these kind of policies sustainable through time? Are we getting more investments in the future? So that's often questions that we may analyze in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco. Those are very tantalizing questions to leave us with. I thought you were going to give us answers, but we'll wait a little bit for that. Motoko, why don't we...
Does this work? Yeah, I'll just stand up. And that'll give us a little bit more energy, perhaps. Good afternoon. My name is Motoko Aizawa. I'm from the World Bank. Thank you very much, Danny, for the invitation to be here today. I was basically asked to not prepare for this. And so I'm not going to talk about my work. I thought I might just pull from the UNCTAD's World Investment Reports over the last 2 years some salient data that sort of caught my eye and made me think in terms of what would that mean for sustainable development. So I'm just going to quote these various data and trend predictions from the World Investment Reports. I have some views about whether they're good for sustainable development or not good for, but I'm just going to suspend judgment. So everything that I'm going to tell you is coming straight from the report. Some of the things really surprised me. So I have four observations that I pulled out. First of all, in terms of context, the FDI flows are overall about $1.5 trillion. It's hard to imagine what that means in terms of the size, but it's still 23% below the 2007 peak, but increased 16% over the last year. So UNCTAD predicts that this sort of moderate recovery will sort of level off in the next year or so. But the interesting fact is half of these flows are from either developing countries or transition economies. Altogether, so 45% from developing countries, 6% from transition economies. And the destination of the flows is not so much in the developed countries. So we're talking a significant volume of South-South investments. I'm sure this is not news to you, but when you think about half of that taking place outside of the traditional jurisdictions, I think that's a really interesting fact that we should remember. So obviously the actors in the FDI flows are the transnational corporations. According to UNCTAD's definition, there are about 8,300 of them. But the interesting fact is that about 650 of these are state-owned. And while these comprise less than 1% of the overall TNCs, they account for 11% of the flows. And again, I think that's something very interesting to keep in mind. There are lots of concerns about state-owned enterprises being an active party in the FDI scene. There are lots of concerns about national security, unleveling of the playing field vis-a-vis various competitors, transparency and governance issues, etc. But this is nonetheless an undeniable trend. The third fact, overall, in terms of international investment agreements, there are about 3,100 or so, of which 2,800 and so are BITs, or bilateral investment agreements, and there are 331 others, mainly free trade agreements and regional agreements, economic partnerships, and so on and so forth. 47 IIAs were signed in 2011. And UNCTAD predicts a downward trend in terms of traditional investment treaties to be signed in the future. And UNCTAD observes that this might be because there is a gradual shift in regional treaties from individual investment agreements, and also that IIAs are starting to be seen as controversial and politically sensitive. That's very interesting for UNCTAD to be saying that, I think. On the other hand, there's also UNCTAD's observation, but I'm sure you know as practitioners, there's some new international investment agreements that feature new provisions, sustainable development provisions, those that ensure that there's non-interference with sustainable development of the host country or encouragement and contribution of sustainable development strategies of the home country, particularly in terms of managing environmental and social impacts of investments. And
And furthermore, UNCTAD observes that there are a number of international policy initiatives in the last few years that are going to have further bearings on the content of international investment agreements, such as the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights that was unanimously adopted by the Human Rights Council in 2011, such as the Principle for Responsible Agricultural Investment that was put out by FAO and the World Bank and others, such as the 2011 revision of the OECD Multinational Enterprise Guidelines, and I might just put IFC's performance standards in the same group of things, and then there's the Rio Plus 20 conference. So interesting trend or not, we can discuss that. And finally, this last thing blew my mind last year when I heard this from UNCTAD. There is such thing as non-economic modes of international production and development. It's a mouthful, isn't it? They call it NMEs. So basically, these are contract manufacturing, service outsourcing, contract farming, franchising, licensing, management contracts, and other contractual relationships through which TNCs coordinate local firms' activities without owning a stake in the firms that are in the host countries. So according to UNCTAD, in 2009, M&E activities yielded about $2 trillion in sales, right? So bigger number than the global FDI flows for last year. And that the cross-border M&E activities is particularly significant and important for emerging markets. Contract manufacturing and service outsourcing alone exceeds $1 trillion. And that the growth in the M&E sector is actually more rapid than the industries that they represent themselves. So this absolutely blew my mind because I come from an institution that finances direct investments, whether it's foreign direct investments or South-South or domestic investments. And we rely on a tried and tested pattern where lenders can control a lot of the borrower's activities. Everything is covenanted in agreement and there's a lot of say-so that lenders have, and therefore we can impose environmental or social conditions. This kind of production, mode of production, would not allow lenders to exercise that kind of control. So therefore, it's a new challenge, I think, in terms of lending institutions like ours. So these are sort of the factoids that I pulled out of, but if you're interested in the UNCTAD reports, they are on the web. They provide very interesting trends and important facts, and so I strongly encourage you to take a look at it. I'll stop here. Thank you.
Thank you, Motoko. I think we've had three presentations that have put a lot of very interesting information on the table for discussion. We had the one question already, but let's take another round of questions and then we can get an answer. So please, let me open it from the floor. People should feel free to ask questions, make comments, talk about the situation in your own country. Just for the sake of the panel, probably, introduce
yourself. I'm still here. I'm a few years ago. In terms of Bolivia and Southern Cone, I wanted to ask, is because of the alignment that you mentioned before, in terms of the different countries, is there a comparative data model that shows whether or not the countries that are not part of this new alignment are receiving more foreign direct investment than the countries in the new grouping? Is there a comparison? Is there a difference? And on a separate note, does this, as part of Bolivia, Ecuador, Peru, and Colombia, although Colombia, there is the Tanzania Trade Act that provides trade incentives for both Ecuador and Bolivia. Their agreement might be in jeopardy for next year. How would that impact if that trade agreement ceased to exist in terms of foreign direct investment in Bolivia?
Thank you. Thank you for the question. I'm not aware of such comparisons, and I think it's probably too early to really know if these foreign investments are, you know, related strictly with these new policies. I can talk about Bolivia. You know, ironically, I mean, this is not a political thing. I'm a lawyer for private companies, but ironically, there's much more income for the government, and none of those companies left the country, even though they are paying as much as three times they used to pay it for the government in terms of fees and taxes. Their rights, as I described, were basically reduced unjustly in many senses, but they're still there. So I have more questions than answers so far. But as far as I know, foreign investments in this particular alignment of countries still there. We don't know what are the other factors or conditions that may, make these companies stay in those countries. But that's the way it's working at this particular moment. Probably we'll see some conclusions in the next years to come. But the popular sense between public officials, at least in the economic ministry in Bolivia, is that somehow this is working, you know, that other policies were not good enough for the country for the last decades, and we are going against what the books says about FDIs, you know, reducing rights, making even local companies have this priority against foreign investors and foreign companies. In a way, it really doesn't make any sense, but it's basically working. The results, I think, will be seen in the next years. It's really too early to have conclusions. As I said before, I just have more questions at this particular moment. And I'm surprised that all those companies are staying. Maybe because they are long-term investors, they have strong incentives to strategically stay in this country. I don't know. I hope in the next alumni reunion I can have more answers to that, you know. But from the academic point of view, it's just fascinating.
In the city in Bolivia, most of the investment is in the natural resource sector.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, Matoko, do you have no offhand what proportion of the flows are up in extractive industries? Because I mean, in that sense, you know, where my extractive companies have to go where the resources are. They can't choose. There's a limited choice that they have. And once they've made the investment, pulling out is incredibly expensive. Unless, of course, the price of the commodities drop, which, I mean, is happening to some commodities, but not everything. So that might be the test that helps us answer this in some way.
Yes, yeah, so I don't have the specific data. The World Investment Report defines FDI as a combination of mergers and acquisitions and greenfield investments. Right, and so I think that the field is a pretty a broad field in terms of sectors, although in terms of dollar numbers, it must be quite significant. Yeah. That's all I can say.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm sure it's easily researchable. I just don't know offhand.
Tim,
my name is Chairman Babe. I'm a 2001 alumni.
I mean, I know in Africa the biggest investments are in the extractive industries, and when you look at the countries that top the list of recipient countries for investment, it's Angola, Nigeria, I forget the others offhand, but they're all extractive industry. They're primarily oil and gas or other sorts of extractive industries. And it's partially, I mean, in Africa, the increase is connected to the resource competition between China and the West, primarily at this point. Though, I mean, there's also a lot of investment coming in from India and from other countries that are also trying to lock in access to resources. On the publish what you pay and the extractive industry transparency initiative, I mean, I must admit, I agree with you that they're good ideas in principle, and some transparency would really be very good if it worked. It doesn't seem to be working as well as it should be. The extractive industry, the EITI focuses on the government revealing what it's receiving, and the publish what you pay focuses on the companies revealing what they're paying. The problem on the company side is they tend to publish what they pay to the extent that they do for a whole country, not project by project. And my instinct is if you really want to understand what's happening, you don't even want project by project, you want contract by contract, so you can actually trace the money contract by contract is where it's going. But I cannot imagine too many companies, even if they're 100% honest and not paying any questionable payments, wanting to reveal that much information because it would be too sensitive commercially to do that. I mean, so I think it's very difficult. The government side is obviously much more complicated. And I think, to be fair to government, it's not just that they don't want to reveal what they pay. I think they, particularly when you look at African countries, the capacity to actually collect the data and be able to publish accurate information in a timely fashion is difficult. And so that it becomes very complicated to do that. I mean, in a sense, and I think this is one of the reasons the Bolivian experience is interesting, is because if Bolivia can succeed in by saying we're going to have laws where social development is the goal of the law rather than helping the investor, and it succeeds, that's a lesson that the rest of the world can learn from. I'm not suggesting you can adapt it completely from one country to another, but it would be a useful experience to look at it and to learn from. I don't know if people want to add to that.
Yeah. So why doesn't it make any difference? I think is your question. And I agree completely with Danny's observation and just a couple of small footnotes. There is a trend towards contract transparency. And that can be achieved either by the government putting out the contract or the company putting out the contract, or both agreeing to put out the contract. In some cases, a best outcome would be legally mandated or a parliamentary process that would make contracts transparent. So I know that there are vibrant discussions in Africa about, particularly in Ghana and a couple of other countries, how to make this work, not just for one project, but for a series of projects in the extractive sector. So contract transparency is one discussion that I think is moving. And then the other discussion that is also moving is, once the revenue is in, what are you going to spend the revenue on, right? And to have some kind of a national framework for the revenue expenditure. and investment. And so my understanding is countries like Ghana have started to think about the national framework, policy framework of investment. So not just about how to regulate the extractives and to disclose the revenues and the contracts, but what are the revenues going to be spent on? And there's a national process, policy process, to come up with a consensus view of the revenue expenditure. And so if a country has the will to look at this from a very long time perspective and to plan it properly over several decades of national activities, I think that there is a potential for countries to be able to be very, very successful and not necessarily using the developed country models, but African models or the Latin American models or what have you. So I'm just seeing the beginning of that perhaps in some countries, but on the whole, it's very difficult to say that all the revenues that resulted from natural resource extraction manifested in something tangible. And then in addition, there are lots of discussions about what do Chinese investments in the extractive sector in Africa really, really mean for Africa and the Africans. Right? So there's a lot going on, but I actually think that there are some interesting case studies that give us hope and optimism in Africa. I'll just stop there.
Shuri, we've been talking a lot about Chinese investment, and I know you have experience working with the Chinese, so maybe you have some observations.
Well, I guess the last three or four years, we are dealing with investment from China. Investment from China is rather interesting because I also experienced the time when the Japanese coming into Indonesia at the time in the 70s and the early 80s at the time. The Chinese company coming to Indonesia, as Matoko said, some of them represented by the state-owned company. And then even for the private company from China, they are still have like incentive from the government in China to finance like 80% of the investment abroad. I mean, the local company, the private company from China, when they want to invest in Indonesia, just come up with 20%, and 80% they can borrow from the Exim Bank or something like that. So this is making all the investment from China to Indonesia. The last 5 years probably is very huge amount. And then I also have some communication with them about how they are doing the investment except in Indonesia. They said they're also very active in Africa, and then they are mainly going to get the natural resources from Africa and Indonesia. And then on one conversation with one businessman from there, they are saying that the government of China now is in surplus of US dollars, and then they don't want to keep the paper in their pocket, so they want to go shopping around and then give out the money to the companies and then let the companies invest in other countries. It's a smart move, actually. Unfortunately, Indonesia cannot do that because we are short of US dollars. So I guess that's my observation, actually.
Thank you. We'll take both questions together. So either one of you can go first.
Last 15 years in Sydney, Australia, where I was mostly in Australia. understand it's more of a question of talking about 60 million people now, directly diverse in 2 billion in a few years, and countries like China, Southeast Asia, India, and Africa are first building infrastructure for these resources, and next off the cap off the ramp, which we know already from China into Australia in particular, is in soft commodities, so agriculture, and the state-owned enterprise is coming in, and yes, it is a political issue. Even looking at our firm, we're in networking for 5 countries. This week, we opened an office for employers in Peru. In the last 12 months, we opened 4 offices, Istanbul, Johannesburg, Casablanca, and now Lima, Peru. And it is very much resource-based in Africa, 2 offices there. And Peru is a huge resource-based but in the resources space, there's a question about transparency. It's interesting to see the SEC hold off during tax. Now the SEC is requiring companies in the oil and gas industry to actually report and disclose their payments to governments to increase the to provide some transparency. And reading the paper today, the oil industry is fighting that tooth and nail as they argue that they have any type of information to see how
thank you. Very, very interesting.
Very nice question. And absolutely, I agree with you in terms of if you are a country without those natural resources, you cannot by any chance try to do this kind of strategy. I think that Daniel was also right. All those companies privatizing former state-owned companies in the natural resources industry made it to Bolivia like 10, 15 years ago. So it's kind of expensive to leave the country. But more than that, I think it's somehow a commercial strategic policy to stay. If you don't have, well, Bolivia has a lot of gas, oil, lithium, which is yet to be exploited. The mining sector is also really strong. If you don't have that kind of natural resources, by any chance you cannot attract any foreign investment in your country. I think the key and the particular circumstances of Bolivia are that it's really rich in terms of mining, oil and gas. Otherwise, no one would invest. And I'm pretty much sure that none of other industries are interested in investing in Bolivia. You know? I don't know. Ford is not planning to build a new car factory in Bolivia. No one is going to invest for I don't know manufacturing or that kind of thing. It's only the natural resources. So that's why I think this special particular recipe works out only in that particular condition. But we still have to see what the next years are giving us, you know.
Did you want to add?
So I'm not an expert on this topic at all, but there are celebrated success stories outside the extractive sector, right? made that was able to attract a lot of foreign investments, such as the India's outsourcing IT sector, for example. That is the biggest success story. But, for example, the wine industry in Argentina and Chile, you know, that is another success story that the World Bank talks about. And they analyze the cluster of different industries and the supply chain being all together, yeah, and so that you can actually create a set of activities that are competitive in comparison to other countries with similar sectors. So various industrial and competitive strategies that are there to promote sectors way beyond the extractives. It's just that the revenues that you could actually draw from the extractives, it's just a very large amount. And so that is a very attractive thing for the countries and the investment life.
Suri, do you want to add? I mean, the other thing which in a sense gets back to the question, the first question, the size of the domestic market. I mean, there are people won't build a car factory in Bolivia, but they might in Indonesia, because with 180 million people, there's a possibility of selling a fair number of cars. I mean, and I suppose the World Bank's response, amongst others, is that's the importance of regional integration and of regional trade agreements, that if you can, you know, a small country can be part of a bigger bloc, that's one way of expanding the market. I mean, I think also the point Motokawa is making about contract outsourcing is another really important point, because that does create more space for smaller units to become part of a bigger production chain. I mean, like everything, there's a good and a bad side to it. So it's not a panacea, and it's not going to solve all the problems, but it does have some positive sides to it. So one and two. Thank you. That's to you.
Yes, thank you. Thanks for the question. So my understanding is that the report is based on a lot of assumptions, right? There is a firm in the capital, the firm size is X, and it has so many employees, and it's in this sector, and it exports or doesn't. I can't remember, but there's like a huge list of assumptions. And then based on the assumptions, there's a team that goes out and interviews lawyers to ask, what is your legal framework for this particular issue? So it's a sort of an interview-based a system, and it gets refined every year, and the assumptions get refined, and sometimes new factors are added, and so on and so forth. So a lot of the information, I think, is dependent upon what assumptions are put on the table. Number one. And number two, I am not sure that the purpose of the report is necessarily to appeal to individual investors. The purpose of the report is to give a government a sense of what they can do to create an investment climate that would be conducive for foreign investors to make certain investments in the particular country. So, you know, the ranking is the ranking based on what kind of reform a government has done. And overall, that may have a sense of attraction or not attraction to an investor. But at the end of the day, as we already discussed, investments get made on a multiple range of issues and preferences. And so I'm not sure that, you know, it certainly would not be advisable, right, for the investor to take that report and pick a country of investments just based on the report's recommendation. On the other hand, there are certain things that have worked, such as the one-stop shop for business licensing. Everywhere I go, smaller companies in particular say, this is one thing that really worked. In the Philippines, in Colombia, in elsewhere, I have heard smaller companies say, this really helped me manage my business. So certain things work, and certain things, I would say, take it with a grain of salt.
So I've been sitting here thinking, here we are at a law school reunion talking about foreign investment, and all the discussion has been about business factors. We've hardly talked about the law at all. And I've been thinking, and was reminded, I have an economist friend of mine who did a study of South African investors investing in the rest of Africa. And he asked every company, he went to about 200 companies or something, and every one of them he asked if they knew about South Africa's bilateral investment treaties with the rest of Africa. And not one person he spoke to knew what a bilateral investment treaty was. And I kept thinking, well, if you spoke to their lawyers, I'm sure their lawyers would have known and would have cared about it. But as I'm listening to this conversation, I'm thinking to myself, are we not talking about the law just because we assume that that's known and important, or is it that it's not that important? I mean, as Marco said, you can change the law in the country quite radically, and it hasn't affected investment all that much. The jury's still out. We don't know if that's correct, and maybe I'm jumping to a conclusion. But I was wondering what the panel thinks. Are we just underestimating the law in this discussion, or is, at the end of the day, our investment decisions not made on a legal basis but on some other basis? Which also gets to Paul's question initially about what are the factors and why is China doing so well if all the traditional factors are irrelevant.
Bill, I need a little bit. Yes, that was a very important missing point. Of course, one of the threats about this, in my particular Bolivian case, is what happens with, for example, the umbrella clause regarding bilateral investment treaties. This government was, I don't know, clever enough to renegotiate with every single international company the terms of those contracts. So they didn't even need to expropriate shares or property or assets. They just renegotiate them. And this company just agreed and executed the new agreements. And probably it ends up concluding that it all depends about revenues, you know, it's about revenues. If a company is going to make a nice revenue, I mean, they are going to invest in Bolivia, in I don't know, Iraq, or Pakistan, or whatever there is, a social turmoil or political crisis. If revenues are good, they are going to be there. In this particular context, I think the Bolivian government was clever enough not to get involved in those legal issues, and they got consented new agreements with these companies. So, as far as I know, we are escaping from international arbitrations as well. But it was a very important remark.
But, I mean, it's proof that the law actually does matter. They got good legal advice, the government, and so they conducted themselves in the way that the contracts envisage, really.
That's right, yeah. That's correct.
Well, I'm more of an expert in terms of individual investments than the legal framework around investments. My inexpert sense is that there is a lot of confusion about the overlay of different types of agreements. So the international investment agreements, the trade agreements, the multilateral, regional, bilateral, etc., and that on the whole there is a sense of confusion among the practitioners in terms of what this means and the need for a new direction in terms of a trade and investment regime at the regional or the global level. There is some sense also that investment agreements and certain provisions that are intended to protect investors may not necessarily they tend to then, particularly when there are disputes and the disputes are arbitrated in international arbitration, that public policy related issues are not addressed in the international commercial arbitration. And so there is some kind of a misbalance of power and access to remedy in terms of those who are making the investments and those who might be hurt by the investment, particularly communities and individuals, and that this unequal or not level playing field is creating some kind of a sense that investment agreements need to be revisited. And so I just generally feel that we're in a transition, and therefore there is some sense of uncertainty about the law, and therefore there are a lot of different opinions, but I also sense some hesitation about people wanting to talk about it.
Yeah. So we have time for one more round of questions. Yeah.
Well, I try to answer that question, but I'm not the expert as well. You know, I'm just a legal practitioner. So I think China is very aggressive now because the main reason is for natural resources. However, in my experience, some of the maybe 70% of the investment to Indonesia is for natural resources, but the other 30% is for other things. Like they are investing in cement factory and then manufacturing of garment and then other things. I guess one of the reasons as well that Indonesia still have the quota for the export of garment to Europe and America, while China has already used up all the quota. And then also for the other country that's coming to Indonesia, probably they are also are using this window to export to another country. And then it's very interesting that China is very aggressive right now. Though because of the coal and, I mean, this is not natural resources, it's like coal and nickel, usually from Indonesia. They are slowing down now, the last 6 months, I guess, because of the price of nickel and coal is going down. I mean, this is very interesting because China coming in with a huge, huge capital and then suddenly slowing down because of the price slump that actually, I don't know, this is very commercial consideration, I mean. So, but it's very sensitive because the price going down, investment is kind of stopped. You know? Thank you. Hope it's answered your question.
Okay. Thank you. So I think to end, I'm going to give everyone on the panel a last chance to say something. The serious thing you were talking about, give you a...
Okay. Interesting about the question before about why China, number one, receiving inflow of investment. I guess the only answer that I know, because I also assist Indonesian company investing in China, is because China have a very special land regulation, I guess, for the investment. So whenever you want the land, then the government just give it to you, like for free, you know. And then the second question the Chinese government asks for the investor is that how many people are going to work in your company or manufacturing. If we say it's like, oh, okay, we will employ like 10,000 people, and then they will say that 10,000 people, you are only a small company, we don't need you. We want you to employ like 200,000 people, 70,000 every shift. You know, that's a huge amount. So I guess people coming to China with one goal, especially for getting mass production of one product, I guess, because they need a big piece of land and huge force of labor. I might be wrong, but that's all I know, you know. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, probably it's a little conclusion without any academic merit. I say that probably according to this experience, like general formulations of recipes of growth are kind of difficult to attain. Probably the answer for developing countries is to have tailor-made legal frameworks in order to attract or restrict foreign investments in their countries. This particular situation in Bolivia is working for the last years. We don't know what the outcome would be in the future. I'm pretty sure this is just for this particular country, having natural resources to negotiate with. But of course, many others, many other countries, developing countries don't have that kind of resources, and of course they have to look for other means of attracting foreign capitals. That takes many years, decades, you know, political stability, for instance, a sound legal framework, trustfully judiciary system is not something that you enact in a law or in a decree. It takes decades. It comes with the overall development of the country. So it's like ironic, you don't know really what's first, the chicken or the egg. But one conclusion would be probably that countries are probably ready to start developing their own strategies of growth. And I hope this particular situation in Bolivia lasts for many years. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Danny. It used to be that within the UN system, there were parts that were responsible for economic development, promotion of foreign direct investments, and other parts that worried about the externalities, such as human rights, environment. Within a country, used to be that one ministry was responsible for investment promotion or natural resource management, and other parts were responsible for labor or housing or other externalities. And I think today we're seeing interesting tendency for these agencies to work together. You might wonder why is it taking so long, but this policy coherence mandate at the UN, which is also trickling down at the country level, or countries taking their own initiative to create that policy coherence and to marry investment policies with sustainable development strategies, I think that is a very interesting development that gives us practitioners a lot of hope. And in connection with this trend, I hope we see a lot of different experimentation, such as the ones happening in Bolivia and in Latin America, in Africa and elsewhere. And I certainly hope that we can learn from the best case studies. Thanks.
Thank you. I want to thank the three panelists for very interesting presentations. I want to thank all of you for excellent questions and comments. As a former director of the ILSP, I couldn't help sitting here thinking, here we are in one room with a group of people, in a sense, randomly selected. We've heard of people with personal experiences from a range of different countries sharing experiences, some of which are the same, some of which are different. But the opportunity to learn from each other in this environment is really a unique opportunity. So I want to thank all of you for sharing that and for making this an opportunity, a learning experience for all of us. And to say, remind you all about the network of alumni and how you can use that not only to collect information but also business opportunities from this. And to say, in a sense, this is the beginning of the discussion, because there are panels later today about aspects related to business. There's one straight after this on combating corruption, and there's one on arbitration tomorrow, where some of these issues will get raised again. And so I look forward to the discussion continuing. So thanks again, everyone. I'm assuming there's coffee outside, but I can't promise that. I don't know for sure. But you can definitely have to stretch your legs for a while. I think we start again at about 3:00.
Thanks.